It's not like there's a deep file of murders involving railroads in Oregon, but the two biggest cases that come to mind quickly both involve the number 13. The would-be robbery that turned into a quadruple murder at the Siskiyou Summit in 1923 happened at Tunnel 13. And today we'll focus on another case, a murder aboard another train a couple of decades later in a sleeping car in lower berth number, you got it, 13. Historian Larry Mullally researched the case extensively, and he'll make a presentation on the murder in Lower 13 Friday evening at 6:30 at the Ashland Library. Larry's here in the studio with us. Welcome, Larry Mullally. Good to have you back.
Good morning. It's nice to be here.
And Victoria Law is with us as well, the Executive Director of the Ashland History and Railroad Museum. And Victoria, this is coming under your auspices, isn't it?
Yes, this is a part of the museum's program, our second Friday history program. Good morning.
Good morning. Good to have you both here. So,
thank you.
Larry, this is an interesting story, and obviously one the Mail Tribune found interesting enough. We had scheduled you before we knew that they were going to do a front page thing. I'm sure some people are shocked this morning. Murder on the... Oh, wait. It's from 1943.
Well, and in 1943, the Medford Mail Tribune covered it again, and their lead on the story, I think, captures how it was perceived by the nation, because this was a nationally prominent crime. The Medford Mail Tribune on November 24th reported how an assailant had crept into lower berth 13 of a speeding Pullman and slashed the throat of a Navy ensign's attractive bride when she awoke and screamed in the night.
So interesting dynamics that set up right from the outset here, because the victim was Martha Virginia James. Was that her name?
Yes.
All right. And she just recently married.
She was 4 months married. She was had gone to a Sweetbriar finishing school in Virginia. First time she'd been on the West Coast, and she was traveling from Portland to Los Angeles to rejoin her husband, who was a naval aviator.
And he, as I understand it, was traveling on a troop train either ahead or...
He was traveling ahead of her, and after the murder occurred, he was informed of this and taken off the train and then brought back on another train and was in Klamath Falls, where the murder train was stopped. The murder actually occurred near Harrisburg. The train was moving 60 miles an hour through a snowstorm, and there was this scream, and then somebody jumped out of his berth and said, "There's been a murder, stop the train." And there she lay on the floor in a pool of blood.
And this was a train on its way from Portland to Los Angeles, the West Coast, is that right?
That's correct, the West Coast Limited.
So a pretty lengthy train, as I understand it, particularly that night.
It was a very long train. It had 18 cars. It had some 305 passengers. In a sense, it's a self-contained world. It's almost like a great ship moving. And the murder occurred. The body was removed in Eugene, but the train kept moving. It was held in Klamath Falls for several hours for investigation and then kept going, arrived 2 days later in Los Angeles, at which point a culprit was apprehended.
Now, the culprit in this case was Robert E. Lee Folks. I mean, this is where it really gets interesting and racial and Southern and a whole bunch of other things at once. Robert E. Lee Folks was a dining car employee of the Southern
Pacific? Yes, he was the second cook on a dining car that was adjoining the Pullman car where the murder took place. But when the murder first took place, a young Marine who said he had seen the assailant leave the car identified him as a white man between the ages of 30 and 40. By the time the train got to Klamath Falls, the same Marine reported that he was incorrect, that it was a black man. And from that point on, it was a black man. All the investigations was looking for the black culprit. And there were about 50 black crewmen on the train because the train contained three what they call deadhead diners. These are diners not in service, but they were being ferried back to Oakland, and they had all their crew with them. By the time you added in the porters and the kitchen crews and such, you had a lot of potential candidates, if it was a black man.
Understood. So one of the issues with the case, though, it seems to be, is that right from the get-go, it seems like a lot of information got out that was not necessarily correct. In fact, just in the first couple of minutes of looking up details on the case through information on Google, you get that Robert E. Lee Folks was a dining car cook. He was a waiter. He was a sleeping car attendant. It seems like the facts about the people and what they were doing at any given time were instantly at least gotten wrong by the newspaper people, if not the police as well.
Well, and they were reporting things that were very prejudicial. It was reported that he had been a prize fighter. He was only 20. Both of the protagonists in the story were 20 years old, Martha James and Robert E. Lee Folks. He'd been a prize fighter, had beaten up his wife, had a reputation for violence in Los Angeles. But then the handling of it from law enforcement in Los Angeles lives up to all one's often, we hope, not true expectations of this of the Los Angeles police at this time. But they did not fail at this point. Robert E. Lee, folks, was he said he'd give a confession if they took him to his home. On the way, they stopped and bought some bourbon for him. His mother at his home said he was drunk when he arrived. The police denied it. He made a confession, alleged confession. They didn't record it. The following day, he made another one. It was different from the first one. They did record it. He refused to sign it. They then posed him in front of the press with various knives from the train, even though the murder weapon had never been found. And this was splashed all over the nation's press because this case was followed not only through the American newspapers. There's clippings from British newspapers, and this is 1943, so this is wartime. But this was definitely the murder sensation of the era.
We're talking about the murder in lower berth 13 aboard a Southern Pacific train in 1943. Larry Mullally is a historian who's been researching the case and will present it in a public talk Friday evening at 6:30 at the Ashland Library. Victoria Law is with us as well, the executive director of the Ashland History and Railroad Museum. And you can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange because there's a lot to talk about with this case, and you may have some questions or comments of your own. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. Was the police work standard for the time? Is that, I mean, I don't know how much you're aware
of. Well, I think the Los Angeles side is pretty unusual, taking a accused man to his home in exchange for a promise of alcohol. And then opposing him with alleged murder weapons, which were not the real weapons.
The actual murder weapon was never found,
correct,
was it?
But in the trial itself, the style of such cases was very different than today. The rights of the accused were quite a bit different. And this was very much a case of what the defense lawyers would consider trial by ambush. Information simply was not released to the defense lawyers. They could not even get a list of the passengers in the murder car. Basically, they didn't know who they could call in for interviews. Since most of the travelers were from out of state, they had no subpoena power in Oregon to bring them into state. In the end, the district attorney prosecuting the case had a group of about 40 witnesses brought forward, none of whose testimony was known in advance, nor did the defense lawyer even have a copy of the alleged confessions, of which there were several, of Robert E. Lee folks.
So the there was no pretrial discovery at that time. It was one of the major
absolutely
things.
Absolutely
not. The defense didn't know what was going on.
Not even a copy of the autopsy report of the victim. The state police declined to release that to the lawyer. So as you follow the transcript of the case, which is about 1,000 pages and available at the Oregon State Archives, you can see that the defense lawyer is basically just looking for something he can tease out. And it all has to be done with verbal acrobatics because he certainly didn't have any facts, compounded by the fact that folks, even with his defense lawyer, could never tell the story twice the same way. It always came out different.
You had a chance. You mentioned the 1,000-page transcript of the trial. I mean, as you look at it now, does it seem like it was just horribly twisted against Robert E. Lee folks?
Well, much of it is fairly formal procedure. What you do see is that the defense lawyers had no witnesses at all to bring forward. There were things that come up that, in hindsight, you can see were contradictory, but unless the lawyer was extremely adept, he wouldn't pick them out. So many things were never reported, so the lawyer was blind. But there was one area that eventually resulted in appeal to the Oregon Supreme Court. That is these confessions, because neither of them were signed. And both of them appear to have been done under some duress, usually by having them take place late at night on a long day in which the defendant was offered food but never seemed to have had any. Those were introduced as evidence and then read verbatim. And that was what the case was challenged on procedural grounds. The Supreme Court voted 5-2 to uphold the conviction, though one of the justices wrote an impassioned condemnation of the process.
Historian Larry Mullally, I keep tripping over your name, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange with Victoria Law from the Ashland History and Railroad Museum. We're talking about murder in Lower Berth 13 back in January of 1943. Our phone number is on the exchange, 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. The racial aspect of this that we've just kind of skirted around up to this point was really quite clear, though. And in fact, I'm looking at an editorial from the Oregonian about this time addressing the topic of black crime. Yeah, I think this is actually in your presentation. The paper declared, when a Negro goes bad, his criminality is likely to take the form of attacks upon white women, and his misdeeds are likely to be associated in some way with a razor blade or knife. Wow. Talk about just taking an entire class of people and saying they do this.
Absolutely. And this particular editorial appeared on the same day that Martha Brinsman James was buried in her wedding dress in Virginia in a church with 800 people. So you had the black-white contrast highlighted to an extreme. Now, further complicating the matter was that Robert E. Lee Folks was a zoot suiter. And you have this whole zoot suit culture in Los Angeles, absolutely foreign to the Oregon scene. And the case was tried in Linn County because that's where the murder took place.
Somewhere between Tangent and Harrisburg, is that
correct?
Right?
But in the entire county, as you mentioned, there were only two black citizens. The jury was mostly made up of housewives, most of whom had never got beyond first year of high school. And living in a county that only had a population of about 30,000 people.
Larry, so, was that unusual for the time, though, to have a jury that had that many women on it?
It was wartime, and I think they just had gathering a group. But to have it take place in a rural county in Oregon where the black experience just wasn't present, and then to have this be nationally prominent, the trial was just besieged with press. And every session was full of people. People on the day of the verdict, they were there early in the day, and people had brought their lunch. And they were sitting there eating their lunch to be there through the whole day until the verdict finally came out in the late afternoon. And he was accused. He was indicted on all points.
Victoria Law, I want to get some perspective from you here as the executive director of the Ashland History and Railroad Museum, because when I think about the fact that this was only 20 years after the incident up at Tunnel 13,
yeah,
the more famous railroad murder in Oregon, it seems like a very, very vast difference between those periods, though.
Yeah, and, you know, for me, when I was reading this story and was reading it last night, and I thought I might have to go to sleep with the lights on. It was just sort of scary. You know, the Pullman car is kind of, in my mind, the epitome of luxury, getting to travel in a Pullman car with the dining cars. You know, when you have the Pullman porters who were these elegant young black men, you know, who had served on as Pullman porters and in railroad cars for, I don't know, they probably since
decades,
the 1890s. And it's just a very sad story, you know. And to me, it seemed like this young man got railroaded. I mean, literally railroaded, right, in that I don't think he was guilty of this crime from my reading it. But, you know, that's and they really didn't give him an opportunity to really be tried, you know, for justice.
So, Larry, yeah, Mullally, were there circumstances that would have indicated that Robert E. Lee Folks could not have been the murderer?
There were, but everything is circumstantial. Within 20 minutes of the murder, he was serving muffins to crewmen in the diner, which was adjoining the murder car. Who were unaware, the people he was serving were unaware that a murder had taken place. They say that he couldn't have prepared the meal and committed a murder at the same time. At one point, he was in the adjoining car and walked through it, where he allegedly, every time he had done this several times, he would unbutton a button on the Pullman berth. But on this particular occasion, he was followed by the Pullman porter, who did not, Folks did not realize he was being followed, and he didn't touch the button. These buttons were never fingerprinted, either by the Los Angeles police or the Oregon State Police, and so nothing came from that. There's another dimension of this, though. As Victoria mentioned, the mystique of the aura of the Pullman travel, even in wartime, was something the railroad cherished, and the Southern Pacific was very aggressive in investigating the case, and then, just like the state police, absolutely refused to release any information to the defense lawyer. So, though the prosecuting attorney had typed out in his office transcripts of 50 interviews, not a single one of these was made available to the defense lawyer. Basically, he had nothing. His defense witnesses were the Pullman porter and the mother of the accused.
Wow. So was there ever, it seems like they decided pretty early this was their guy. Was there some suspicion placed back on the Marine who'd given the report about, it was a white guy, no, it was a black guy?
He was arrested and held as a material witness and then released. He also testified in the trial. The defense lawyer did not pick up the nuances with him well enough, did not take advantage of possibly trying to transfer the blame to him. He was the one who appears to have discovered the body. He had blood all over his arms, and which he didn't wash off for several hours afterwards. But he's the one that fingered the black assailant.
Murder in Lower Berth 13 will be the presentation by Larry Mullally, our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. Victoria, when and where?
It will be this Friday, November 8th at 6:30 p.m. at the Ashland Public Library.
At which room?
The Gresham Room.
Okay. Good to have you both here. Always good to talk railroads with you, even if the subject is somewhat grim, as it is in this case. Larry Mullally and Victoria Law, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.